To talk about optics, which is the study of light, we first need to understand what light is. And before we can understand what light is, we actually need to take stock of what we've just done for the last, whatever it is, two or three months. Okay? 2 months. So let's summarize what we've learned. Okay? There are some fundamental equations that we've come into contact with. Okay? Does anybody remember the name of this one? The surface integral of the electric field dotted into the area vector on that surface equals the charge inside the surface divided by the permittivity constant. Gauss's law. Okay? There's another one we didn't spend much time on because it's fairly boring because there's no monopoles. That's sort of Gauss's law for a magnetic field, which is the surface integral of the magnetic field over a surface A is equal to zero. Okay? So this is sort of Gauss's law for B field. And the reason this is zero and this isn't is that we have real isolated electric charges, positive and negative, and we have no isolated magnetic charges or monopoles. We also saw that the path integral of the electric field over that path is equal to the negative, or the opposite, of the rate of change of the magnetic field through the, it's kind of a mouthful, through the surface bounded by that path. So what was this one? What name did this one go by? So it's the path integral of the electric field over the path equals the rate of change of the magnetic flux through the area bounded by that path. No? Okay. That's Faraday's law. Okay. So this is the one that allows us to think about induction. Okay? And then we did one which is a very interesting one, which is that, analogously, the path integral of the magnetic field over a path is equal to a constant, the permeability constant, times the current bounded by that path. Okay? What was this one called? Ampere's law. Now, when these were all come up, they were all derived over about a 100-year period or maybe a little less. They were written in different notations, blah, blah, blah. But when Maxwell, a guy named James Clerk Maxwell, came around, he wrote these things down similarly, and he noticed some very interesting aspects of this. Aside from the letter E and B, the left side of these two are exactly the same. And the left side of these two are exactly the same. They have the same structure. Okay? Now, we understand why the right side of these two are different, because there's no monopoles. Okay? But then you can ask the question, well, why is the right side of these two different? Okay, well, the lack of monopoles can explain why there's no magnetic current here. Right? So there's this term. You can imagine there would be something analogous over here. So that makes sense. But then the question is, why is there no induction in this one? So why can't I, if I have a changing, here I have a changing magnetic field, I induce an electric field. But why, if I have a changing magnetic field, I have an induced electric field. here, why, if I have a changing electric field, why can't I have a changing and induced magnetic field? So that would be sort of magnetic induction. Okay? So what Maxwell said is, okay, I don't know why. There's no reason I can think of that says this can't happen. If I have a changing electric field, I should be able to, I have no reason to say I can't, produce a changing magnetic field, or I produce a magnetic field. So what he did was he said there should be a piece to this that looks like this. So he keeps the piece from Ampere's law, but he generalizes it and says, we should be able to create a piece that describes magnetic induction, the induction of a magnetic field from a changing electric field. These constants are put here to get the dimensions to come out. Okay? So that's all he did. I mean, he didn't, you know, basically he noticed there was a symmetry and he thought maybe there was an argument that, okay, if it is possible, it should happen. So let's hypothesize that there is this process, magnetic induction. Okay? Now, before he did that, we already had seen by this case, where we have an electric field on this side and a magnetic field on this side, that electricity and magnetism are related. Okay? And also, we've got a current, which is an electrical phenomena, and a magnetic field here. Those are electricity and magnetism, they're related, all right? But by adding this term, he's basically saying that aside from the lack of monopoles, electricity and magnetism are governed by the same law, meaning you have induction here, you have induction here. So he's unifying these two things, electrical and magnetic phenomena, okay? Which is actually, that's a big deal. So he did this, he hypothesized this. Okay, fine. Now, how are you going to test this? Well, let's consider a capacitor. So in this capacitor, I have electric field lines going like this. And if I look at it from this side, these electric field lines are going into the board. Okay? Now, the thing is, let's have a change in electric field. Okay, we haven't talked about this much before, but of course we can have changes in electric field in capacitors. So we're going to have a change in electric field. If I change the electric field here, what does that say about the electric flux through a surface there? If the electric field is changing between these two plates, what's happening to the electric flux? It's also changing. Okay? Okay, so this becomes a way that we can test this. We're going to create a situation where we're changing the electric flux explicitly, and we want to see, now we don't have a current, this is a capacitor, there's no current through here, okay? It's just a gap. All we're doing is changing the electric flux. So we can isolate this component of this generalized Ampere's law to see if we get a non-zero value of the magnetic field, okay? Well, basically what you see is when you do this, if you were to vary the electric field smoothly, and so you've got a current coming in here and then leaving, but there's no current here, all right, then what happens is you will get a magnetic, what you observe is that you get a magnetic field perpendicular to the electric field, but basically described in this way, sort of turning around, all right? But you get a magnetic field that's perpendicular to the electric field, and the magnitude of it is governed by this relationship, meaning the path if you were to use the generalized Dampier's law, if you integrated over this path here, that circular path, then you could integrate the magnetic field you observe over that path, and you should get what you know to be the change in electric flux. Okay? And this is observed. So this is observed to obey the generalized Ampere's law. So there is magnetic induction. Okay? And it's described precisely by this relationship that Maxwell just popped into there. Now, it's a little bit unfair to Gauss, Faraday, and Ampere that these equations are now called Maxwell's equations. All he did was add a piece. He didn't even come up with one of these equations. He just added a piece, but they're named after him. Okay, I think it's most physicists think it's very, very unfair. Now, if you take this relationship, so forget this term, if we just take the relationship B dot dl equals mu naught epsilon naught d phi e dt, okay? Now, if we take this relationship, this is just the magnetic induction piece of Ampere's law, and we consider it the way that I've done it. So I've got a circular path, and So what this becomes is B times 2 pi r, where r is the radius of this path, the circular path. And we know that the flux is equal to the area, the E field, times the area. So what area are we talking about? We're talking about the area of this region that the electric field is going through. That's the region bounded by the path that I've drawn here, this circular path. Okay? So we know that that's a circle. It's the area is pi r squared. And what this allows me to do, let me get rid of all this now. If I take this expression and simplify it, I would end up with the following. Okay? This is when r is less than the radius, the outer radius of the capacitor is capital R. Okay? And there's another one if it's big, if little r is bigger than capital R. I won't go into that. Let me think about this for a second. Let's say that we have little r is 50 millimeters. So, about that big. So that's how big the capacitor is. And let's say that the change in E over time is a smooth 10 to the 12 volts per meter squared. That's 10 to the 12 volts. This is a very big number, huge number. But let's say that we could change our electric field by 10 to the 12 volts. Now, it's per cubic square meter, so that's a pretty big area. I can plug these numbers into our expression, and what we get is the magnetic field that's induced is 0.0028 Gauss, which is a really tiny, tiny magnetic field. Very small. So we don't get a big magnetic field induced, But we do get one, and it is detectable. Okay? And so when that was observed, basically the conclusion was that electricity and magnetism were the same thing, that they were unified. Okay? Now, something interesting comes up about this. Let's see. Okay. If you look at the equations that I drew, we can go back to that generalized form of Ampere's law. Maxwell noticed one other thing, which ended up having, it took decades basically to figure out what it actually meant, but it had a pretty big implication. So let's consider just the inductive piece of the generalized Ampere's law. Okay? This is what we had just written. Now, let's consider that we're going to have, let's take a coordinate system. And this picture is in the book, if it helps. So this is the x-axis, y, and z. And what we're going to do is we want to understand something about what the phenomenon is that what the phenomenon is that's relating electric field and magnetic field. So, first of all, let's imagine that we have a changing electric field that's moving, sorry, a changing magnetic field that's moving and is oriented in the z direction. Okay? So we have a magnetic field that's oriented in the z direction, but it's varying as a function of x. Okay? So B is varying as a function of x and t. That means that the B here is different than the B here. Okay? Now, and let's take this path. Okay, so we have a path here. And this path width is delta x. I mean, I've blown it up. Let's call it dx. I've blown it up, but it's a little tiny width, dx. And it has a length, this rectangle has a length of L. Right? So what we want to do is we want to understand something about the relationship of these two things. So first, let's take the left side of Ampere's law. The path integral of B dot dl. Well, B dot dl here for this segment, and this dl is going to go over this loop. This piece and this piece, those dls are perpendicular to the magnetic field. Okay? So B is perpendicular to dl here and here. So those two pieces don't contribute to the integral, to the left side of this expression. This side and this side do. And I'll just go through a little bit what this would look like. So we need to know now what is the magnetic field here and what is the magnetic field here to do the rest of this integral, because we want to do it. So this piece in this integral contributes B times L. We don't know what B is at this position, but it's some value, B of X. And then this is B dot dl, so this is B times L. Okay? And then going in the opposite direction, because we're going to be going through the path, we have a minus sign, and we have whatever B is at X plus dx, again times L. Okay? So this is the left side of this expression. On the right side, we have We can turn the flux again into the electric field times the area. Okay? All right, so I've just gone through this and tried to write this expression down. Now, I can write this a little differently. I can simplify it. This is D of B, delta B, times L. So I have some delta B going from here to here. I have some delta B. And that's times L. And then on this side, I can write this as the area is L times dx. This is the area of this square. So it's dx times L. Okay? And so I have L dx times, and now the mathematicians should start to scream. We suddenly go into a partial derivative, and I'm not going to defend that. But this just means that this is the change in the electric field as where everything else is held constant except the variation in time. It's a partial derivative. And if you don't know what those are, bug me later, and I'll do a little calculus 101. Now, there's another piece where the mathematicians will really freak out, which is where I'm going to write this now as we could write this in this way, delta B over delta X times delta X, okay? Okay, that I could write that. I just put in a delta x over delta x. And now we can change this a little bit so that this is the partial derivative of b with respect to x. And this is dx. Okay? That's, again, where the mathematicians will be very unhappy. But, okay, somebody has looked at this in more detail mathematically and demonstrated it. But the important point here is that I'm just sort of doing the algebra to understand crudely from this example what the scale of things is here. So, you know, our integral gives us this, and I can write that symbolically this way, and I've already gone over here and done this. Now I can cancel out my L dx on both sides. Okay? And so what I end up with is the partial derivative of a B field with respect to the x coordinate is proportional, with a negative sign, the partial derivative of the electric field with respect to time. Okay? And there is an analogous one, which I won't derive, where I just flip my B and electric fields here. Okay? All right. I'm almost there. Okay, I'm almost there. All right. I need to make some room. Okay. Can I erase the drawing here? Yeah. Can I erase the first two lines here? Yeah? Okay, so we have these two expressions, this one and this one. Okay? Let's take the one on the right. Okay, so that's, I'm just rewriting the one on the right. Now, okay, We're still processing this information. What we're really doing, I haven't said it, what we're really doing is we're trying to come up with a differential equation that will describe the properties of the electric field or the magnetic field as a function of space and time. We want to relate those. So we're trying to come up with, we're trying to get rid of the B. We got an E and a B in this expression. We want to get an E and an E. Okay, we're trying to come up with a differential equation that describes the electric field or the magnetic field. All right? So, next step, T. take the partial of both sides with respect to x. Okay? All right. Well, now I'm going to flip. I'm going to rearrange terms here, and I'm going to get that this is really the same as this. Okay? All I did, I moved the negative sign out of the derivative, and I swapped dx and dt. Okay? Well, now I got... but now we should notice something. This piece, okay, is this, which is equal to this, which is a function of the electric field. So now what I can do is I can rewrite this as okay. Let me clean this up. It's pretty messy. What this really looks like is this. The second derivative of the electric field, partial derivative, with respect to time, equals this constant mu naught epsilon naught times the second derivative of the electric field with respect to time. Okay? Now this is actually, this is another point in the class where you should be in awe. This is actually a really interesting equation, and you've seen this before, okay? The place that you've seen this before is waves. It's a wave equation, okay? Except normally, the way it would look, the way that you're used to look from mechanics, what you would have seen in 1303 is you would have seen this. Imagine I've got a string that I'm waving up and down, so the amplitude in y vertically, the change in y as a function of position is equal to 1 over the velocity that thing is moving forward versus its the second derivative with respect to time. This is a wave equation, okay? And it's almost exactly, it's the same structure as the one that we just wrote down, except that instead of having a nice, neat 1 over v squared, we have this strange mu naught epsilon naught. Okay? Well, when Maxwell wrote this down, they actually knew what these constants were. Okay? So you could say, okay, let's just say that this is describing the electric field is a wave. Okay? That's not what I was thinking, but let's say the electric field is a wave. That means that this thing must equal 1 over the velocity squared. Okay? Or you could go and say V equals 1 over mu naught epsilon naught square root. Okay? And you can calculate this. You can plug in the numbers for mu naught and epsilon naught. And what you get is that this is 3 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. Okay? Which really surprised Maxwell and everybody else, because there was another number that they knew in physics at that time, which was a quantity called C. There was another number that they knew experimentally, which was a quantity called C, which was 3 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. Except they didn't think this had anything to do with electric fields. If I go through this with magnetic fields, I'd get the same number. They didn't think this had to do anything with electric or magnetic fields. This is the speed of light. So now we have this idea of an electromagnetic wave that's propagating through a vacuum at the speed of light. And the question is, what is this thing? I mean, what does it look like? Can we think about it in terms of what it might look like? So this is going to be really horrible, and I apologize profusely, but even if I wanted to use a transparency, the projector is not working. So basically, let's consider this to be z, this to be y, and this to be x, and then the same there. So we have two sets of axes here. And what we can think of is that, okay, well, that's the way that this is described. We talked about having an electric field and a magnetic field moving, and they're perpendicular to each other. So if we, let's say that the electric field is oriented in this way, so it's oriented along the y-axis. So it's oscillating up and down in the yx plane, okay? And so let's we can draw arrows to show the direction and magnitude of the electric field, okay? Now the question is, all right, so then this would keep going. It's a wave, it just keeps going. Well, what would the magnetic field component of this look like? Well, I'll do my best. Here's what you might see if you were looking at the magnetic field. So this, say, is oriented in the z direction. Okay? And I don't know if that shows it to you clearly, but basically what you see is that these two things are oscillating together. All right? Now, there's a couple things to note about this. This is T. And so the velocity C is in this direction. So this direction is C. This direction here is the E direction. And this direction here is the direction of B, all right, in terms of a coordinate system. And the relationships of these things, the way that these are described, is that the electric field, and actually, the way I've drawn it is actually using a sign. And so these would be the solutions to the wave equation that we talked about last week. And actually, I'm going to change back again. Very sorry. This should be cosine. Those are properly the actual solutions. Okay? So what we see is that E only depends on X, and it only depends on T. Okay? So I could, this wave is going to be propagating just like a water wave in some direction, X, and it will be varying in time. Okay? All right. So it's only a function of these two. And there's a couple things you've seen this before with waves from mechanical waves. But this k factor is going to be 2 pi divided by the wavelength. The wavelength is equal to this length. It's the length that it takes to go through one complete cycle of oscillation. All right? And omega, you already know, is 2 pi. It's the angular frequency. It's 2 pi times the frequency in hertz. And it's also useful to know this, that omega over k equals lambda times f, which equals c. Okay? So these are all relationships that are useful to keep in mind. Now, I won't go through it, but The fact that these are the two solutions, and the book talks about it, there's one other relationship that's worth keeping in mind, which I want to make sure that I don't write it down incorrectly. There's one other relationship that comes out of this, which is that the electric field equals the speed of light times the magnetic field, the magnitude. Another way to write that is that the slope, or the ratio, I should say, of the electric field to the B field magnitude is going to be equal to the speed of light. Okay? So this ratio will come up later. And since the speed of light in our units is a gigantic number, this tells you, and we've kind of seen evidence of this when we talked about magnetic induction on Thursday, this generally means that the scales of electric fields in our units are large, whereas the scales of magnetic field, naturally speaking, are small. So magnetic induction produces a small magnetic field, but it can produce more easily a large electric field. Okay, so this is kind of what it looks like. Now, there's a couple things here to keep in mind. This is called a transverse wave, okay? A transverse wave means that the direction of propagation, x, and the direction of the amplitude, y or z, are perpendicular, are transverse to the direction of propagation, okay? So this is a transverse wave. And there's a couple things also. So one is there's something called polarization. All right. Now, what polarization is you see that the electric field has a particular orientation here. Okay? And now that orientation could be changing. If I have a bunch of light, I could have all kinds of different waves with different orientations of their electric field. And in fact, these lights, actually after the break, I'll have to, I should have grabbed something out of the demo room. But basically, these lights emit electromagnetic waves, which have an orientation of their electric fields that are, you know, in any direction. Okay? And, but there are cases in which you can have light that is polarized, meaning that all of the waves are, have it, well, the polarization refers to the case where the orientation of the electric field stays the same. Okay? And by definition, I mean, not by definition, but by the way that we've done this, the B field is too. It's always 90 degrees away from that direction. Okay, so polarization has to do with the orientation in the transverse direction of the oscillation. Is it in the Y direction? Is everybody in the Y direction? Then there's a polarization. You could talk about things that are 75% polarized, saying that 75% of the waves are oriented in this direction and 25 in another direction. Okay? The other thing is the idea of a plane wave. So in a plane wave, let's just think about the electric field for a moment. Let's say that I have my oscillation. Here's one of my waves. And it looks like that, okay? But I have a light source, and let's say I could get that light source somehow to emit all of its waves in lockstep, meaning that, you know, this is X in this direction, okay? So I have another wave emitted, and it peaks and troughs in the same position and, of course, in the same time, because these are the same wavelength of light, but in the same position here. So that means that at every point here, I always have a maximum, a minimum, a maximum, a minimum for all of the light that I'm going through. And what this does is it means that the wave front is essentially a plane. Okay? if this was the start of the wave and then it just goes to zero, this is where I turned it on, then the front of the light wave would just be a planar surface, essentially. And then all of a sudden I'd start to see oscillations. But this first peak, they would all be in sync. They would all arrive, say, at some screen here at the same time. Okay? So that's a plane wave. And that the phenomenon here, this is different than polarization. This is referring to things are in sync, if you will, in the x direction. Polarization is saying that things are lined up in the transverse direction. How do you generate these things? Okay? And because we've now determined that light is an electromagnetic wave, well, how does the thing get generated? Well, we've already got the answer in that we need to see, we know that we can create a magnetic field from, so we can create a B from moving charge, okay? Which means that there's an E field that's changing, okay? So we know we can do this. We also know that we can create an E field from changing magnetic field, okay? And so these two things are actually how we got the wave equation. There's a second order derivative. So E is also related to the second derivative of this E is related to this E. So the question here is, what does this say about generating waves? Well, here we just have a velocity, okay? But if we have just a current moving, for instance, we create a magnetic field. We haven't created an electromagnetic wave. To create an electromagnetic wave, we need to have the electric component. So we need to have an acceleration. So EM waves are generated by accelerating electric charges. And one way to think about that is imagine you have an atom. So we got a plus here. Let's forget that. Just think about the electrons in it, okay? And so we have some atom here. And what happens in an atom is that if I can get this thing to vibrate up and down, oscillate, okay, what's happening to the electron? What's happening to the motion of the electron? What's its velocity doing? Its velocity is changing, right? So here, if I cause an oscillation, it means that E is accelerating. First it's going up, then it's going down, and it may be accelerating even within there, okay? When I have this happen, I start getting electromagnetic waves, okay? This is exactly what happens. So now it could be heat. That's a form of electromagnetic wave. Infrared light, what we would call infrared light. There's also visible light. when you look at a stove and you heat it up, that's what you're seeing. If you can see the burner, if it's an electric stove, that's what you're seeing. Okay, you're seeing that those atoms are oscillating, and the hotter they get, it changes the wavelength of the light. Now, okay, so you need an accelerating charge to produce electromagnetic waves. Well, how do we really do it in general? Because I've told you that light is a wave, but also radio waves are a electromagnetic wave. Okay, they're all related. So how do you do this? Well, the way that you do this is you go back essentially to the LC oscillator, the RLC circuit that we had before. So if you look at it, you have an AC source, okay, put a capacitor, an inductor, and a resistor. And then so you have a resistor, an inductor, and a capacitor. There's AC here. This is actually basically going to be a transformer here, but I ignore that aspect. What happens is you're going to induce in this wire, and this is an antenna, okay? What you're going to do is you're going to induce in this conductor an oscillating electric field based on an oscillation in the field the magnetic field that you generate with this inductor. Okay? So, and we've already seen how to do this. In order to do this, I will get a resonance. I can make something with a significant oscillation if I have, I will get a significant oscillation here when my AC source, and I have a frequency here that's a characteristic of this circuit, which is 1 over the square root of LC. So I can control the frequency of the oscillations of the electric field in this conductor by controlling the components of this RLC circuit in the way that we talked about before. Except now I'm not receiving. We talked about how a radio receives electromagnetic waves and then uses that to drive things like speakers. So that was actually doing the opposite thing. What we're doing is we're going to drive this oscillator so that it causes electric field to change. So here we have a changing electric field in the antenna. And what happens when we have a changing electric field in this antenna? What's going to happen to the electrons? So I have an electric field that for some moment in time is this direction, and then at some point it's going to oscillate so that it's going to change to go in this direction. What's going to happen to the electrons in this conductor? They're going to accelerate. That's right. They're going to oscillate. They're going to go one way, then they're going to go the other way, blah, blah, blah. Okay? So we have now caused an oscillating, accelerating electric field and movement of charge, which means that I'm now going to get electromagnetic waves to be transmitted by this device. Okay? And I can control the frequency that transmission, that wave is generated at, based on the properties of my LC circuit here. Okay? So it's not that different from the opposite case that we did, which is the receiver, but this is a transmitter. And, you know, if I have enough power, I can really send these waves very far so that somebody miles away can hear my radio transmissions. Okay? And, you know, you could do an example. So for FM, the frequency is around 10 to the 8th hertz. And you know this is 88 to 108 megahertz. Okay, that's what it looks like on the dial. And I could pick an LC that would give me that frequency. Electromagnetic wave, it's a speed of light. But then you see from Maxwell's equations, it's consistent, you know, these solutions that have a cosine omega t minus kx, okay, or I may have it backwards, but, you know, that omega, there's no prediction of what the omega should be. What is the frequency? There's no prediction. And it turns out there's no limit. The frequency could be mile, the wavelength of electromagnetic waves can literally be miles. Radio waves, really long wavelength radio waves, could be miles. And then there could be very high energy gamma rays where the wavelength can be 10 to the minus 12 meters. Okay? So just to give a little indication of the ranges, radio waves are usually defined to be greater than a tenth of a meter. So these are wavelengths, one oscillation, is about that long. Okay? Those are radio waves. Then there's microwaves. And these are not set definitions because different people tend to use different definitions. But in general, these are in the ballpark. So microwaves are generally 10 to the minus 4 meters to a tenth of a meter. Infrared, which is usually the wavelength that we associate with heat when we can't see the thing glowing, okay? Infrared is 7 times 10 to the minus 7 meters to 10 to the minus 4 meters. Okay, so these are covering big 3 orders of magnitude, 3 orders of magnitude, many orders of magnitude. Okay, these are huge ranges in wavelength. After infrared, we see visible, and it's sort of humbling to realize, actually, that the visible spectrum is not even a factor of 2 wide. So it goes from 4 times 10 to the minus 7 meters to 7 times 10 to the minus 7 meters. This is a factor of 1,000. A factor of 1,000, a factor of 1,000. This is not even a factor of 2 in width. It's this. Our eyes are sensitive to just this tiny sliver of wavelengths, and it has something to do with what can pass through the atmosphere. There's also ultraviolet, or UV. This is 6 times 10 to the minus 10th meters to 4 times 10 to the minus 7th meters. And then we have X-rays, I'm sure you've heard of. And this is 10 to the minus 12th to 10 to the minus 8th. And then you have gamma rays, which is less than 10 to the minus 12th. And, sometimes people say 10 to the minus 10th. And actually, I mean, this number can go very, very low. For instance, we do particle physics for our research here, and so we are dealing with photons, what we call photons. These are incredibly high-energy gamma rays that are several orders of magnitude lower than this. Almost a million, almost 6 orders of magnitude lower in momentum than this limit. Okay? So you're going from on the order of a meter, and this could go up to miles, as I said, down to these incredibly range. And the only reason that we stop here is because there's a limit to how low of a wavelength we can even get to, or how big of a wavelength we can even be sensitive to. Okay? All right, so that's electromagnetic waves. And this here is called the spectrum. Now, there is a subset, which is the optical spectrum, which you're more familiar with if you've ever looked at a prism. And this is the thing that goes from violet to red, with things like blue, green, yellow, orange in between. Okay? That optical spectrum is what's confined to this range of visible wavelengths. So the short wavelength, 4 times 10 to the minus 7, this is blue or violet. The long wavelength, this is what our eyes see as red. Okay? So our eyes are actually able to determine with incredible precision, if you look at the range of wavelengths, we can tell very fine detail in terms of, is it orange, is it red, is it orange-red, is it, is it more red than orange? I mean, we could see very fine gradations in color, which means that we could see very fine differences in wavelength. These waves have energy associated with them that can be important. So There is a quantity that is defined called the Poynting vector, spelled with a Y. And this parameter is given as 1 over mu naught times the cross product of E times B. Now, okay, that's kind of a mouthful. Why would we define such a quantity? Well, it turns out that this quantity is actually related to the energy density in the electromagnetic wave that we want to deal with. Okay? There's energy in an electric field. We've already seen this. There's energy in a magnetic field. So we'd like to quantify the amount of energy that is stored, essentially, or inherent in the electromagnetic wave that we're talking about. And so it's related to the magnitude and the direction of the electric and magnetic field. Now, so this is for a plane wave. This is the general expression. For a plane wave, this is just equal to EB over mu naught. So again, we're taking many waves, and we're saying, well, things are perpendicular, so we can get rid of the cross products. But this quantity itself is actually equal to the energy per area per time in the direction of motion of the wave, because it's the cross product. So it's perpendicular to E and B. So S has a direction. It's in the direction of propagation of this transverse wave. Okay? No.
How much energy is going in the direction of the wave?
Yeah. These waves have energy. Okay? I mean, you know they have energy because if you put your hand, in the hot sun, you'll feel it heat up. What are you feeling? You're feeling that energy is being imparted to kinetic energy of atoms in your arm that are starting to move back and forth. They're absorbing this energy, and it's giving them kinetic energy. Okay. Now, how that process happens is very complicated. We have to talk about quantum mechanics, whatever. But there's energy there. So there is energy involved in these waves. And so what we could do is think of, this is fine, this is what it is at any instant in time. What would it be averaged over many cycles? So in this case, we could think of, we'll call it S average, and this is going to equal the maximum electric field times the maximum magnetic field divided by 2 times mu naught. Now, I'm not going to go try to derive this. We don't have time. We're still a half a day to a day behind. But it's basically the same kind of thing that we've done. This factor of 2 is coming from the fact that the average of an oscillation, okay, the average B field, or the B RMS, is equal to B max over the square root of 2. So if I've got a B max over the square root of 2 and an E max over the square root of 2, I'm getting my 2 here. Okay? So hopefully you can see kind of conceptually how this thing comes out of this. And now we can also use this piece of information that we had a bit ago, that the ratio of the magnetic and electric fields is the speed of light. Okay? So I can substitute that in here, and I could write, for instance, Emax over 2 mu naught C, Emax squared over 2 mu naught C, or I could write this as C Bmax squared over 2 mu naught. So again, I have this electromagnetic wave, and the average energy per area per time is proportional to the square of the electric field or the square of the magnetic field. And we have this proportionality constant C in here because, as we said, the inherent size of the magnetic field in our units is small.
Okay? So we can calculate this energy directly by knowing how strong the electric or magnetic field is. This is the only number that we have here. These are all, you know, mu naught, C, those are constants. Okay? Okay. So now this, there's a, I won't go into it much, but this actual parameter, the way that we've defined it here, is also called an intensity. It's useful to keep that in mind. And so you would imagine, I mean, it would, I don't think would surprise you to think if I have a really bright light, I have more energy being transmitted by that light than if I have a dim light. And so we use the word intensity to refer to that, but mathematically, it's referring to this average energy per area per time. Okay? Now, average energy per area per time, this is also could be said as power per area, because power is energy per time. Okay? Okay. Now, okay. Now, there's one other aspect of this. Well, I'll use problem 11 as just an example. So the question is, in problem 11, you have an intensity of 1 kilowatt per meter squared. And the question is, what is the energy density? Now, what this is referring to, this is referring to energy per volume. Okay? This is not S or S average. This is energy per volume. Okay? However, we're out of time, so there's a little derivation in the book. But there is a relationship between intensity and the energy density, which is that the energy density, did I write this down right? Yeah. The energy density times C equals the intensity. Okay? And this is not current. Please keep I separate from the idea of current. Okay? So based on this, we have a surface and we have a bunch of waves. Each of these waves has some energy associated with it. So let's say that this surface is complete absorption. Then what happens here, there is a momentum change, certainly for the light, which is, so this, let's say that these waves have a total energy of U. And this momentum change is going to equal U divided by C. Okay, divided by the velocity. So this is the momentum transferred from the light to this surface. Now, it's possible, there are actually cases where you can build a collector such that the light will be absorbed and you will start to see something move. But, of course, you have to have a very frictionless, most of the time it just gets lost in friction and things like that. That's why we don't just start drifting away when the lights are on. And it's also a very small effect. But so this would start moving. But even if it doesn't because of friction and all those things, it does feel a pressure. Okay? And so, all right, well, a pressure. And unfortunately, the book uses the symbol P. So I am going to try to make this look like a P like that, just to keep it separate from the little p of momentum. So this pressure is equal to some force divided by area, where I have an area of some surface.
Well, a force, so I have 1 over area, a force is dp dt, the change in momentum with respect to the change in time, which also gives me ddt times ddt of this expression, the energy divided by the speed of light. And then I can finally write this as 1 over c times 1 over a du dt. And this here equals the magnitude of the Poynting vector. It is the energy per area per time. Okay, so what we just had with the Poynting vector, this is the magnitude of that. So the pressure that I get is equal to 1 over c times s, just the magnitude, because energy does not have a direction, it's a scalar. Okay? So this is for 100% absorption. Now what would happen if I had let's write this. Okay, so this is S over C. And that's total absorption. But what would happen if the light came, hit this surface, and was reflected back? What would this pressure be now? It's not absorbed. It comes